Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm your co-host, R.A. Edwards, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul on this, the 20th day of July, in the year of our Lord, 2013. America, in 7 days, has changed. Her complexion and her face, and hopefully, based on a very powerful reflection and speech by President Barack Obama yesterday from the press room at the White House, a honest reflection and commitments, legislation, whatever you want to call it, that may work to deal with the problem of race in America. This time last week on this program, we were talking about awaiting the decision of a jury in Sanford, Florida, in the matter of the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman in the death of Trayvon Martin back on the 26th day of February, 2012. We speculated here, as did everyone else. My co-host, Mr. Don Allen, who will not be with us today, discussed the implications of a verdict on both sides of the aisle, a verdict of guilty and a verdict of innocence. We must say, as a journalist and as a longtime historian and activist and et cetera, we were not surprised by the verdict, and we would refer those who are listeners of these programs, readers of our columns, websites, and et cetera, that unfortunately, 2.5 weeks prior to the verdict in Sanford, Florida, last Saturday evening, we had indicated the chances of a guilty verdict were 70 to 30, which basically means that it will certainly not happen. We said in our column 2.5 weeks ago that we prayed to God that we were wrong. In fact, in that column, we were talking in terms of probably the most courageous and honest witness at that trial, Rachel Gentile, the 19-year-old naturalized American citizen born in Haiti. A young lady that some need to be reminded could speak 3 languages, Creole, Spanish, and English. A young lady who represented what is a troubling aspect of the American educational system. A person of color, a Afro-Haitian, struggling with the educational and meticulous process of education here in the United States. But that did not make her, quote-unquote, a dishonest or factual witness to the events that took place in February of 2012 in Sanford, Florida. Now, with the President of the United States taking up the mantle of the importance to address the, quote-unquote, elephant in the room, we now see ourselves faced with the backlash, if you will. Sean Hannity, O'Reilly, and others calling the president a troublemaker, a manure stirrer, though they use the other word, if you will, a man who has betrayed the trust and et cetera. Well, we reject that. In fact, we will use this specific word in briefly discussing the very emotional and very factual speech that the president gave. The president was extremely presidential. That's why people are elected to the office of President of the United States, president of any nation, if you will, to be presidential, to bring forward the kind of discussion and the kind of healing that a nation needs to go through. I thought that he was superlative in his reflections on how black people feel, because there is far too little of that in this nation, through the media specifically and et cetera, about how we black Americans feel. The things that trouble us, the things that bother us, the things that annoy us, the things that anger us, the things that cause us to fully believe that we are truly not a part of this nation and its so-called institutions of democracy. I've reminded some of my colleagues and friends around the country, as we have discussed this in the 7 days since the jury made its finding, a jury comprised of 5 Caucasian women and a quote-unquote Hispanic person of dark complexion, whatever that was supposed to mean. We have said that one should not have been surprised. I am troubled by many in my own community who some way or another thought or attempted to convey a thought that these 5 Caucasian women sitting on that jury particularly would have seen Trayvon Martin as one of their own. In fact, the president sent a very clever and yet profound and compelling message when he said, last year I talked about Trayvon could have been my son. People ridiculed him for that, and etc. Yesterday he was even more pointed when he said, Trayvon could have been me 35 years ago. And what he was also saying is that my life could have been taken 35 years ago, and I would not have enjoyed the legacy and the opportunity to serve this nation as its president. I would not have enjoyed the opportunity to put forward the views and the feelings and the sensitivities and the pain of the African American. For those that are out there, take it within that context. Understand that the president's reflections yesterday were well thought out, were well crafted, and were predicated upon his own history. It's no accident that he talked in terms of hearing car doors, locks click, if you will, Caucasian women pressing their purses, stepping to the other side of the elevator if they were able to, being followed around stores and other places. We are reminded of the statement by the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, just a couple days ago, speaking to the NAACP meeting in Orlando, Florida, where he talked about the fact that he can remember how many times he was stopped, and he remembered the last time he was stopped in Georgetown in Washington, D.C., by a white police officer who asked where he was running to. He was running to see a movie. He was not running to flee or to commit a crime. And as he pointed out so profoundly, that actually brought both a gasp and an applause from those gathered at the NAACP convention, that he was a federal prosecutor. But in the minds of that white police officer, he was just another black person. Another NIG, if you will. Another slave. Another person to be disrespected. Another person to have suspicion of. Another person to be dismissed as being human. And certainly another person being dismissed as having equal rights and equal privileges that had been accorded to white Americans since time immemorial, since they, quote-unquote, first set foot upon these shores and lied and betrayed the trust of those who were already here, the indigenous people, the red man of North and South America. These are the things in which I think that the president was saying, that in some regards it serves no purpose for, quote-unquote, the massive dialogue and the rhetoric. And as a 74-year-old African-American who has been involved in the struggle since he was 19 years old, and even before that as a student in school, I well understand the futility of having high expectations that America will change on the question and the proposition of race, racism, race baiting, race nullification, and etc. We have seen it far too many times before. You see, I am blessed enough within my own life experience to have been a young Negro when Emmett Till was brutally, brutally murdered in Mississippi, to the extent that his beloved mother had the tremendous courage to insist on his funeral in Chicago that his casket be kept open so that all those that came to view could see the brutality that had been rendered upon him in murdering him, mutilating him, and destroying, quote-unquote, his life and his future. We remember many, many occasions as a maturing young Negro in the late 50s and coming into the 1960s and the insurgency and the upheaval that was taking place. We can well remember African-American or Negroes, as we were still called then, leaders, being assassinated, being brutalized, being made to disappear, and knowing deep down in our hearts that J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI and all of the other institutions of law enforcement in America really had no interest in solving anything. We remember the bombing of a church, but there were bombings of a lot of black churches in America and in the South. Some obtained significant, quote-unquote, coverage and publicity. Others were to be muted, if you will, by whatever specific situation existed in the particular enclave, in that county, in that town, even in that state. And we remember it even then in the 1960s as the Negro was being killed on the highways and byways of America, as their churches were being blown up, as their leadership was being murdered and imprisoned, and etc. Who can forget Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a jail cell in Birmingham, if you will? And then later, how can we not forget the murders of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Medgar Evers, NCAA President Moore in Mississippi, and numerous others? And there were white Americans who joined with us in that struggle of the late 1950s and the 1960s. There were white Americans who lost their lives, who were beaten, if you will, but nowhere did anyone suffer the casualties and the numbers that we did in black America. And then we moved into the civil rights pieces, if you will, even before and after the Civil Rights Voting Act, and et cetera, signed by Lyndon B. Johnson, and the euphoria that we as young Negroes and old Negroes felt with regards that maybe free at last, God Almighty, free at last. The March on Washington earlier, before the 1965 Voting Act, the enormous crowd that was drawn by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the so-called Civil Rights Coalition of Whitney Young, Roy Wilkins, James Farmer, and others, if you will. That then, too, also was a sense of pride. But no sooner than folks had gotten on the buses and drove back out of Washington, D.C., it was back to business as usual. Black churches were being bombed. Civil rights workers were being killed. In fact, some civil rights participants in the March on Washington were killed in different parts of the South. Who can forget James Meredith, a man marching and gunned down on a highway, though he survived in Mississippi because he was marching for the freedom to be educated, if you will. I mean, think about these things, my friends. And where I'm leading in this first 14 minutes of today's program is that we've always been told the same fairy tale, that things will change in America, that things will be better, that we must be patient, but first and foremost, we must be nonviolent. And so we then come into the early 1990s, and we remember clearly the destruction of Los Angeles, the second time, by the way, the first time in 1965, when police beat two young brothers in front of their home and in front of their mother in South Central L.A., 1965. And the year prior to that, places like Newark, New Jersey, and Rochester, New York, had gone up in flames. Detroit, Michigan, cities in which for the first time in many, many, many years since the reactivation of the Black Codes, that federal military was called out to deal with, quote-unquote, the Negro upheaval, if you will, in insurgency and insurrection, and et cetera. And so there has been a whole body of activities and et cetera, and this is what in a most presidential way yesterday, President Barack Obama brought forward. And it is needed. It is needed for the psyche of we in Black America, because we had clearly began to lose hope that our president was still focused upon his own ancestral knowledge, activities, involvement, and et cetera. And so a accommodation of tremendous respect and et cetera set out to this president, if you will. But those who are oftentimes paid to undermine the best of efforts have already stepped forward, if you will, both Black and white. In fact, one that we want to mention because he represents just the opposite of everything that President Barack Obama and the Martin family and many of you out there who are listening to this program represent. Charles Barkley, a man who has become renowned for taking the opposite position against the interest and the franchise of the African American, spoke out on some sports program, if you will, and indicated that it was the right verdict and that he had followed the trial closely and that he was keen and et cetera. We question, in fact, if Mr. Barkley followed closely this trial in Stanford, Florida, or if, in fact, he followed any of the activities, actions, motions, and et cetera prior to this trial over the last 15 months following the devastating and criminal act carried out by George Zimmerman in the death of Trayvon Martin around 7:15 on the 26th of February in Sanford, Florida. But Charles Barkley will continue to be a contributor and commentator for the NBA Network and ESPN and TNN and et cetera. And I don't know how much damage Charles Barkley does, but it must be said that Charles Barkley is certainly not a symbol, quote unquote, of a respected point of view within Black America. I mean, here's a man whose latest claim to fame was that he was receiving oral sex in his car in the back of an industrial park in Phoenix, Arizona, and had to go into Sheriff Apollo's, quote-unquote, legendary and notorious prison camp and put on one of those little pink uniforms, if you will. Everyone tried to, well, not everyone, but those who were supporters of Charles Barkley tried to make it into a joke, if you will. Of course, Charles Barkley's wife and children were never asked their opinion about their quote-unquote daddy, a man who is a trick in many respects. Not only is he a trick for the sex piece, but he's also a trick as it pertains to giving away his money on the gambling tables in Las Vegas and Reno and Atlantic City. And so when I heard Charles Barkley becoming the spokesperson for Black America's quote-unquote opposition to the fact that this was not an appropriate trial, and not an appropriate trial in the context that it did not serve justice. Oh, it served justice. It served just them, if you will, and certainly did not serve just us. But we've come to expect that. And that chronology that we gave you in the first 17 minutes of this program represents just a small, minute part of the history of this nation and the continued failure to be able to address the issue of race. And most certainly race and violence and the abuse of the franchise of the sons and daughters of the African. And so there will be discussions and et cetera over the coming months, I assume. The president will have to be careful on how he deals with recommendations and suggestions for solutions and et cetera. But in the meanwhile, my American friends, the tragedies will continue. The violence will continue. Crime will continue. Black on black, black on white, and et cetera. Here in our own city, just last night, as people were talking in terms of doing the right thing and getting ourselves together, and et cetera, another young African American gunned down in North Minneapolis, if you will, where we have all kinds of deployments of police and Negro leaders, if you will, according to the news accounts that always come out almost on a daily basis. And yet a young man is shot and killed on his birthday, if you will, in a level of continued violence along the 3600 block between Emerson and Fremont here in the city of Minneapolis. But the continued issue is just how much we really know and how much attention we really pay to the trial of the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman in the death of Trayvon Martin. And so we, this afternoon, with the luxury and the ability that we have to control any and everything we talk about, if you will, we'll begin to take a look at the trial, starting with the pretrial. In fact, we're going to go back to not only that fateful night in Sanford, Florida, but we're going to take a look at the political events that took place, and we're going to segue into some of the testimony of trial, because contrary to a Charles Barkley, we did spend every possible minute listening to and reviewing the testimony and reflecting back to the many statements that we heard over the last 15 months prior to the gaveling to order of this trial by Judge Nelson, who made herself some interesting rulings, which had an immediate effect upon the prosecution's case. But the prosecution was not uncomfortable with that because they had ample time to have appealed some of those decisions under Florida law with respect to the decision by the trial judge, if you will. And by the way, Judge Nelson was not assigned as the original trial judge, and we'll be talking about that in the next 10 or 15 minutes of this program. Events which took place, which has been muted, really, that's the word that we would use this afternoon on this program, emanating from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the muting of so much crucial, critical information and analysis about the integrity of the prosecution of George Zimmerman. Starting with the 44 days that he was allowed to be properly prepped. Nancy Grace, just about 20 minutes ago on her television program on HLN, was, and I'm not understanding, though she's so dense in some regards, was showing the tapes of the interviews of George Zimmerman at the Sanford police station on the night that he murdered Trayvon Martin. And we were weighing that in our own professional way with regards to how much sharper he sounded later on down the line during the course of television interviews, if you will, and depositions and additional information that was put forward as if it was in preparation for his testimony. You see, the prosecution, by the way, for those of you out there, had to know early on, long before the trial, that there was no way in the world that Mark O'Mara and Don West, a former DJ jockey, disc jockey, if you will, ever intended to put George Zimmerman on the stand. Now, it's one of the reasons that one hopes that the Martins move ahead with a second civil action, if you will. There has already been a first civil action, according to blogs, and a settlement by the Martins, which may, in fact, hurt their ability to file another civil action as it pertains to the verdict and George Zimmerman's involvement in the wrongful death of Trayvon Martin. We're just not sure on how a Florida court will rule on that. And certainly the jury is still out, if you will, if the Obama administration and Attorney General Eric Holder will have the quote-unquote intestinal fortitude to charge George Zimmerman with violating the civil rights of Trayvon Martin. That's something that is still tenuous at best at this hour and will be interesting over the next number of weeks to see if the Department of Justice does charge him, particularly before he is allowed to get out of the country, because one must understand that George Zimmerman's supporters and his family are doing everything they can to get them the hell, to get him the hell out of the United States of America. They would like to get him to a non-extradition treaty country, if you will. But given the lack of popularity and the hatred being expressed toward George Zimmerman, a lot of those are third world countries, and I'm not sure that they are interested politically or otherwise in accepting him. And so that means it has to be a European enclave. And our sources tell us here that it would be Belgium, that George Zimmerman would be welcomed because of the interesting history as a part of the Belgium culture and their long-standing, quote-unquote, colonial abuse of the Black Congo and of Black people, if you will. For those that want to research it, Belgium's a rather interesting country with respect to its meanness, and that's being a kind word. Its brutality is a more relevant legal word. Its brutality towards Black people, and et cetera. And so in Belgium, the feeling is, particularly amongst the Flemish population, that he would be seen as somewhat of a hero, quote-unquote, who took on the problem of Black violence, of savage, ape-like violence in, quote-unquote, the United States of America. And so the word is that preparations are being made to allow Georgie as the juror, juror B-37, like a bomber, talked about in her interview with Anderson Cooper, that Georgie would be well received probably in Belgium and may be able to exist for a period of time. But my sense is George is going to have to keep moving around, if you will. He may not ever be able to return to the United States of America. And if the Department of Justice decides not to prosecute him, it's going to be more difficult, based on a civil suit filed by the Martin family, to have George Zimmerman returned to the United States under even extradition treaties, given the politics of racism and support for his position. And so that would also explain the kind of assistance that he received. See, no one talks in terms of that 44-day window in which George Zimmerman was allowed to, quote-unquote, be crafted and shaped in such a way that he came across much better. You see, the murder of Trayvon Martin took place on the evening of the 26th of February, and it was not until the 11th of April that Ms. Corey, the special prosecutor appointed by Governor Rick Scott, Republican, Ms. Corey, by the way, state's attorney in Duval County, I think that was like the 11th prosecutorial district there, but Duval County, the main city, Jacksonville, Florida. Angela Corey, and many of our civil rights leaders knew this when she was appointed on the 22nd of March by Governor Rick Scott, that she was legendary in overcharging African Americans. In fact, it was her that overcharged the African American female, Melissa Alexander, who now there is a tremendous effort being made to highlight the miscarriage of justice rendered upon her for merely discharging a weapon at her husband, an African-American who bragged about the fact that he beat all of his women and that they knew their place. And so on April 11th, 44 days after the killing, the murder of Trayvon Martin, Ms. Corey announced second-degree murder charges against Zimmerman, and Zimmerman then surrendered to the police. On the 23rd, 12 days later, Zimmerman is released on bail, which is interesting. And then on June 1st, 2012, his bond was revoked as concerns that he did not fully disclose his financial status and et cetera. I guess so, when he had over $250,000 in a secret account, which actually had been open for him by his mommy and daddy, whose names are never mentioned. Finally, they talked about Gladys, his mother, if you will. But his father is never reflected upon. Nothing is ever said about his father, who we should be able to talk about his father. His father's a federal magistrate, a member of the United States judiciary, if you will, and a man who really did an excellent job in those 44 days in shaping and cultivating the big lie, if you will, which then raises a serious question about the role of a federal magistrate who should be impeached and removed from office based on the kind of involvement he had with preparing his son to cover his son's tracks in the murder of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. This is one of the things that the media in this country has stayed away from, the very interesting role of the Zimmerman family. The brother is nothing but a flash, but specifically put out there to draw attention away from the mother and, more importantly, George Zimmerman's father, a man of tremendous power, if you will, a man with many powerful friends at court, including people deep inside the Department of Justice and the FBI. I'm not sure that Attorney General Eric Holder is really prepared to take on the portfolio that is carried by George Zimmerman's father. Not George Zimmerman, you see, because the system, the media, has done everything that they could to keep George Zimmerman's parents, particularly his father, away from any scrutiny, if you will, away from any spotlight, if you will, away from any crosshairs, if you will, as being quote-unquote a target, a person of tremendous power. It was interesting to watch his father's testimony. It was interesting to watch the deference, we use that word again, the deference and respect that was paid to the father on the stand, if you will, when he testified, as the deference offered to his mother during her testimony on the issue of was that George's voice, if you will, on the so-called 911 tapes and et cetera. And yet, they were the only two of, 39 witnesses that testified at trial? They were the only two witnesses that were never asked what it was that they did, what was their life experience. Even the so-called George Zimmerman uncle, who is a sheriff's deputy in Orange County, which is a county adjacent to Seminole County, and working closely with his beloved sister, Gladys, George Zimmerman's mother, a man who talked about, though, that he, for 26 years, served the United States military until his retirement in the late 1990s or maybe 2000. It all depends on which security agency puts the information out. But his uncle, who basically did not have anything approaching a command of the King's English, in fact, Rachel Gentile actually had a better command of the King's English than George Zimmerman's uncle, who testified in what was just a theatrical moment that he was sitting at his computer at his home. And though he knew a little bit about George's troubles, that he had not spent any time really assessing it. He had not talked to his sister, George's mother. He had not talked to George's father, if you will, but that he was sitting there at his computer one evening and the news was on and his wife was watching the news, and all of a sudden he heard a scream over the television, and he testified under oath without a lot of intense cross-examination because he had credentialized himself, which really was never verified by the prosecution, that he was a honored veteran of the United States military, 26 years, retired the rank of Master Sergeant, and then became a bailiff in Orange County, and then became a deputy sheriff in a growing Latino-Hispanic population there in that part of Florida. By the way, the demographic breakdown of Sanford that people should think about, which is quite a bit different than the breakdown outside of Sanford in Seminole County, but inside of Sanford, 78% white, 12% Hispanic, Latino, and 7% African American. African American presence is much larger outside of Sanford, Florida, in Seminole County and the rest of the judiciary district, but yet no African American was able to be selected out of the jury pool to become a member of the 6-member jury, if you will, which is jury nullification and et cetera, which actually the prosecution should have fought with tenaciousness to have a group of truly Trayvon Martin's peers on that jury. But then back to the preparation for George. George was well prepped. His father had played a very significant role in helping George to get his story together, to provide the necessary misrepresentation and lies as it pertains to the events of that evening. But then something that has amazed me as a journalist and a historian and one who has followed closely this American tragedy, with a black person once again being the victim, was that particular period of time on April 23rd, George is released on bail, if you will. It was quite clear that websites had been set up and that Rush Limbaugh and O'Reilly and others, Hannity and others who represent the very bowels, quote-unquote, of segregation, nullification, reversal, and racism in America, yes, the very bowels, if you will, were raising hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars for the defense, and this is what, of course, brought Mark O'Mara and his buddy Don West, who Don West seemed to wipe his nose quite a bit during the trial. For those of you that say you watched the trial, Don West, to me, seemed to be a white man with a cocaine habit, if you will. In fact, he does, if you will, but, you know, certainly that will never be ever brought out. But again, for those of you that say you take the program, you watched it, take a look. We counted it 23 times in that 2 weeks. Don West would just, I mean, I've never seen such gross conduct, would actually take his sleeve and wipe his nose because his nose was draining. Now, of course, people could say that he had allergies or et cetera, but for a white man making the kind of money that he's making and certainly is going to make, he should have been able to find prescription medicine and et cetera that would have, you know, loosened up, if you will, and then, quote unquote, tightened up that problem that he was having with that nose, if you will. These are little traits that are important when one talks in terms of the level of participation in putting together the defense and developing witnesses. Do you realize that some of the witnesses, particularly Mr. Pollack, the white man who allegedly had the gym, who talked in terms and certainly appealed to the jurors that George was just a powder puff and et cetera. George may be a powder puff now, but when you look at the film, quote unquote, of his physical demeanor on the night that he murdered Trayvon Martin, he's fairly tight, if you will. His physique looks pretty good. He, you know, there's none of that puffiness and et cetera. And, of course, George had been working out for 3 years, really, involving himself in self-defense, the martial arts, and et cetera. That's all how that testimony by Mr. Good, if you will, indicating that he George, was being attacked by someone who was applying so-called martial arts, if you will, to Mr. Zimmerman, who absolutely was defenseless, according to the position and the assumptions that the defense were attempting to provide to the jury, which in fact they did, but I don't think that it was extremely difficult. But it was the preparation. And so one never talks about it. Let's just walk you into this, if you will, and phone lines are open for those that are aware of the secure line that has been provided. People should have been concerned when on June 1st, 2012, his bond was revoked, as we said at the top of this program. And the reason for his bond being revoked was that the judge was informed by what appeared to be initially an FBI correspondence to the court indicating that surveillance of Mr. Zimmerman had revealed the fact that Mr. Zimmerman, number one, had lied about his financial status and et cetera, but that also Mr. Zimmerman was possibly preparing to flee the country, which he most definitely was. Now, no one talks about that now. When you talk about all of the programs, the Anderson Coopers or the Hannitys or whoever else, including even our own black commentators, you probably only will hear it here on this blog radio broadcast that we are driving this particular point and saying to people, for a man that was being so touted by his supporters, that being George Zimmerman, in the murder of Trayvon Martin, why was it necessary for this man? Of course, he's an habitual and pathological liar. I mean, he's lied about so many things, if you will. But why, for a man who allegedly was going to be exonerated, remember many of the programs on cable and even network, the interviews and et cetera, particularly the interview with Hannity where he lied, he, George Zimmerman, lied about his knowledge, innate lack of knowledge about stand your ground, the castle law, self-defense, and et cetera, when in fact it was ironic, too, that his instructor, one of his key instructors in helping him understand better stand your ground, the castle defense, and et cetera, was a black instructor who also happens to be a commander in the United States Navy who went to great lengths on the day that he testified. It was kind of puzzling, but he obviously, brother man, had gotten his instructions when he actually called out to George from the witness stand, "Hey, George, how you doing?" Which was certainly a signal that certainly this African-American, a commander in the United States Navy, an instructor at Seminole Community College, you know, just thought that George was a great guy, if you will. And so that was a little bit of theater in which really the prosecution should have jumped straight through the ceiling, because actually no one else that testified, including his mommy and daddy, were bold enough to do that. But this brother, this African-American, this commander in the United States Armed Forces, a professor who was also teaching, if you will, Florida law and self-defense and et cetera. So George Zimmerman in the summer of 2012 lied when he was on the Hannity program with his attorney, the so-called white version of Johnny Cochran attorney, Mark O'Meara, who I've watched closely the reruns of the tapes. Mark was kind of shocked when George said he had no idea, no clue about what stand your ground, castle law, none of that was. And then less than a year later, his instructor, in fact, two of his instructors, the other one came on by strife, if you will. He was out in Wyoming or New Mexico or something doing some hunting. And so that was an interesting element. But the most important that we are pushing as it pertains to this program today, emanating from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, was that when George Zimmerman's bail was revoked and agents, federal and state agents, rushed to his home, they knew right where to find his passport. A second passport that had actually been facilitated for him by his daddy, by his father, the federal magistrate, the government, U.S. government official. His father had illegally facilitated that second passport. That's why all of a sudden, suddenly, if you will, there was no further discussion about the circumstances and events leading up to the preparation to flee the United States of America. So in June and July of 2012, George Zimmerman and his supporters didn't have a lot of confidence in the American system. His attorney, Mark O'Meara, who was a part of, quote-unquote, this action, this devious, illegal action, felony in nature, that they didn't have the confidence that they were going to be able to win, though George was still being put together. His father and others were working with him to make sure that he stayed the course and told the big lies that needed to be told, but they still, on June 1, 2012, they were not comfortable enough that they had, quote-unquote, galvanized the necessary support within the state of Florida and particularly within the jury pool that they already knew was going to be selected and what it was going to look like, that there may be a problem, if you will. And so George was getting ready to flee. Initially, he was going to flee to his mother's. And the reason we're emphasizing this was the absolute stupidity of the juror that was being interviewed by Anderson Cooper just last week, who referred to him, George, as if she didn't know, as a Latino or a Puerto Rican or et cetera. George Zimmerman is not a Puerto Rican extraction. His mommy is a Peruvian, born and raised in Peru, if you will, as is his uncle, who served for 26 years with American Black Ops Special Forces in South America, disturbing the tranquility and democratic institutions of South America. His uncle, who is now a deputy sheriff in Orange County, adjacent to Seminole County there in Central Florida. A man who, as he pointed out, served loyally. Oh, yes, he did, when you talk in terms of the uncle's portfolio and some of the stations that he was posted to, if you will, military term. He was quite the agent provocateur and operative, if you will. But George was preparing to flee. I mean, why would you want to flee this system of justice when people like Rush Limbaugh and members of Congress and others were saying that you had done the right thing? In fact, your attorney, at the same time that your bail, George, was being revoked by a circuit court judge, was of the opinion that everything was all right. We have a call coming in. Hello? Yes, sir, caller. What do we have for you? We're going to put you up, and you have a question. You're calling us from California. Okay, go ahead. What is your question?
Well, one of the questions I had was it was basically about Zimmerman, and it was more so of a comment that I had. A lot of things that I didn't understand about the prosecution of it, which to me, as I've heard you say, it almost seemed like, 70-30, but it almost seemed like they threw the case where they didn't object where they should have objected. It was a shame. I think everybody pointed out the miscarriage of justice that we have all seen in our legal system. I think that's one thing that just has to be put out there, and I think should continue to be put out there about the prosecution. And I don't think that's being talked about enough as far as their incompetency with this trial. Here I'm in Los Angeles, of course, and there's been protests, and there have been protests that have gone the way of the Rodney King verdict, where young males, and we don't have to say we know who they are, there are young people, have been running into stores and have literally just ransacked the store. And the stores are in the Crenshaw-Laverne Park neighborhood, which is the neighborhood that Magic Johnson owns, tons of businesses. And so what subsequently has happened, there's a minister, Minister Muhammad, who is one of the leading ministers here, a Muslim brother, in Los Angeles. And so what we have done is we are now, and I say we as far as Minister Muhammad and the community, has a rally, and it's going to be one of the biggest rallies. It's going to start at Magic Johnson's park. It's going to be motorcycles, lowriders, everyone. But what Minister Muhammad has done is he's given out a directive, and he held his tongue back. If you decide that you want to act out, we have the FOIs here that will deal with you differently than even the police will deal with you.
And by the way, caller, the FOI, Fruits of Islam, the Special Security Forces of the Nation of Islam, correct? All right. Continue on, sir. Continue.
But that's what I hope that we continue in that vein of peaceful protesting. I was at a rally yesterday, and it was beautiful. A few hundred people. It was peaceful. But what was amazing was that the undercover cops, undercover officers, were videotaping all of us. They had two on each end, and they had video cameras, and they were videotaping. And it looked like they were purposely pointing the camera at certain people. And I just thought that was pretty amazing. One last thing that I want to say is that, you know, I know that we've all had, and I hope, especially I'm talking to all the brothers, and I know we've had, and I hope a lot of us have had that conversation with our children on how to conduct themselves. And I just want to say, I think, and you know, we've all been told to, you know, give our children a hug, which we should do anyways, but we should have did extra hard after the verdict. But I think we should also give our fathers a hug because of, and those of us who have managed to and have happily stayed out of the system, I just think we need to give our fathers a hug, our mothers a hug, and just say thank you. Thank you for the job that you've done. I think we should all do that to our parents. So,
let me just ask you one question, sir. Again, you're calling in from California. We're going to be wrapping up, by the way, and we certainly would appreciate you listening closely. And if you decide to call in next week from the coast or one of your associates, we'd appreciate it. But please give us, in a minute's time, your observations of President Barack Obama's address to the nation yesterday.
One of the other things that I apologize that I haven't. I forgot to do that. I was going to call in and do that as well. I want to say I've heard you be a little hard on him. I've heard Tavis Smiley, Cornel West, they have raked this brother through the coals. And I think yesterday with that speech, as soon as I heard him, as soon as I saw his mannerisms, where he looked down and right, where he was thinking, I said he was making history. And I said, I think everybody should apologize for the things. You haven't been as negative as Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. Nowhere near. But I just think he's owed an apology. And I think that they could take that label off of him, that he's not going to weigh in on issues of the community, because he's weighed in heavily. And I don't think there's anything else that he can say. The Justice Department's getting involved. If I could just add one more thing, I know we all want them to bring charges, but I think it will just open up a can of worms that we really just don't want opened up right now. Where they'll be able to put Zimmerman on the stand. But then they can bring into a lot of negative things about the family, the child, a lot of things that were suppressed with the court. So,
all right. All right. Thank you, sir. And listen to the last pieces as we talk about George Zimmerman's preparation to have fled America back in June of last year. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. Caller out of California, we had this specific caller who is working with a number of organizations. We are very cognizant of the caller and the organizations that they are affiliated with out there. They have really been putting some tightness together because of police in the last 5 minutes. We're going to touch on this very quickly because of police subversive activities in an attempt to cause disruption and et cetera. And embarrass the Trayvon Martin movement. This caller had contacted us and indicated that they wanted to at least share with us what the Nation of Islam and some others have insisted is going to happen under all circumstances. So we appreciate the caller out of California, and we appreciate the organizations that he is involved with, as well as we have additional chapters and organizations out of Florida, the Carolinas, Georgia, Missouri, Illinois, New York. We appreciate the good brother taking the time. Let me complete as we move towards the conclusion of this program. Again, as we said, our co-host, Mr. Allen, was not able to be with us today. We're down to about the last 4.5 minutes, as I said to the caller that just called in. We want to raise this question for the mainstream media, the so-called majority media, the top-notch New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, our little newspaper up here, the Dallas Morning News, and the Miami Herald and others. Why was it that your institutions and papers did not spend more time in 2012 conveying and sharing with us the information that exposed the fact that George Zimmerman, his attorneys, and specifically his mother and father, who are government officials, were negotiating for him and had made preparations, plane and everything had been prepared, money transfers, and et cetera. But we will say this, as we've said on our television program that will air here tomorrow. And by the way, on that program that will air here tomorrow in the Twin Cities, which many of you on the local scene know about, we will show the first crime scene pictures of the tragic death of Trayvon Martin. And there is a specific feature in the picture that shows him laying on his back dead, if you will. And we want to see if people pick up on what specifically it is in that picture that raised serious questions relevant to the testimony by the defense and even the prosecution's witnesses with respect to scientifically and forensically being able to expose the lies that were being told and were being crafted. We were shocked. We had been told and warned about this. We had to negotiate through our television production team the picture being made available to us so that we were able to post it. We acquired it on late Monday of this week. It will be on our program on tomorrow. It is a graphic picture. It is a chilling picture of a young African American whose life clearly has been taken, and it's clear that a lot of facts, et cetera, were being falsified. But in the last 2 minutes, we want to push this issue from our platform, and we have the ability to control that platform, is that why there was never any discussion that the person who exposed George Zimmerman and his father and others in the master plan to allow him to flee was the man who now the United States of America desperately wants back, Edward Snowden. On our television program here tomorrow in the Twin Cities, we go into great detail of Edward Snowden's role in exposing the conspiracy that was afoot, that was to have allowed George Zimmerman to flee the United States and take a chance and on the consequences of his fleeing the United States of America with the help of his father, mother, and others, some of whom were United States and Florida state government officials. It is a sad commentary about injustice, culpability, conspiracy in the United States of America and the failure of the criminal justice system to serve justice. We appreciate the opportunity to be with you. We'll be back next week. Our co-host, Don Allen, will be back with us. And continue to pray for yourself, Black America, because God knows that you need the support and the structure of support of our Savior. These are very, very difficult and very, very dangerous times in Black America, but also it's dangerous across the entire United States. On behalf of the production staff, we want to wish you the best. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning.